Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of An Imperfect Leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. Thank you for joining me for this encore episode, where we explore the challenges and triumphs of leadership, the pursuit of educational equity, and the journey of an imperfect leader. So today, I am thrilled to visit with a tremendous leader, a man I met with the Chamber of Commerce from Athens, Georgia, when they wanted to exchange ideas with a sister city. So, you know, I got partnered with their superintendent, Dr. Damon Means. And, you know, we had a blast. He'll have to tell you whether or not he thinks the same thing. But he immediately established himself as someone who didn't just talk about removing roadblocks for better access for students. He helped build better systems. And as you can imagine, I wanted to spend more time with this guy and even made plans to get together so we could continue to talk about schools and leadership. But then, you know, this pandemic kind of put a wrench in our plans. So today on An Imperfect Leader, Damon Means joins us, and Dr. Means is the superintendent of the Wauwatosa School District, a school district.
You said it well.
Did I say it? Did I do it?
Yes.
It's a district just immediately west of Milwaukee. So, Damon Means, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you and talk with you again.
Yeah, you too. So, Damon, I remember our dinner on that stage of the Missouri Theater. I didn't know what to expect. You get invited to a lot of things as a superintendent. But then I got to meet you, and I didn't want that evening to end. And, you know, you, like me, have had, most of your experiences, I think, in sort of city schools. But then you, like me, found yourself in a more what would be considered rural and suburban in Athens, Georgia. And then now, like me, you've returned to your professional roots, you in the Milwaukee area, me in on the West Coast in the Seattle area. But let's first explore your origin story. What was your first job that you ever had?
My first job was I was a social studies teacher. I was a high school social studies teacher in a predominantly white, affluent school system, and had the very best time of my educational career there. It was, they gave me the freedom and the opportunities to teach some courses that were electives. So I taught a course called diversity and inclusion, and I taught about different religions and race and ethnic groups, and I taught a course called contemporary issues along with U.S. history and world history, and I was able to make connections with all students of all walks of life, and it was a great time.
So you had the ability to create and craft this elective course, and students signed up for it. And I'm curious, how did that help you as you then started to move into leadership? How did that position in particular prepare you to be a leader?
You know, it was interesting in that I was the person of color on staff, the only one out of a faculty of maybe 70 or 80 people. And they gave me these courses and assumed that I could do something. You know, I'm a fresh out of college, 22-year-old. They made a gross assumption. But I think what I learned was that it's about connecting with people and listening to them. Little did I know I was being prepared for the superintendency as a teacher in teaching those courses, because it was never about the right answer. It was about how did you get to your conclusion and what pathway did you take? And so I, in a way, I treated my class like individual board members. There's no right or wrong answer for a board member. It's just, how did you do your homework? And are you able to defend the position you're taking? My job was to provide all the information in a unfiltered, but also unbiased manner. and to answer questions as they were developing their platform, if you will. Little did I know that I would take those skills into the job that I've spent most of my career doing, which is the superintendency. But I've always had this pull on me to really try to help the, you know, students who are underprivileged and don't have as much. And so I felt that, you know, I had to take on a greater challenge. It was time to take on a greater challenge, although I had a great situation in my district. So I went on to a district called Clark County in Athens, Georgia. Being a Wisconsin boy and Milwaukee kid, I never left Wisconsin. So it was my first time being out of the state. And that school district was about 14,000 students. I would say about 75% students of color, between African-American and Hispanic students. And it was a great opportunity to really dig into some of the more complex challenges that we see in, you know, regardless of the size of the urban district, some of the complexities and challenges that you see in urban districts.
So you have a statement that I read that is pretty powerful and speaks to what you've just described in terms of leveling the playing field or finding opportunities for children who have been underrepresented in many parts of school, in terms of, I'm sure, advanced placement courses, those types of opportunities. And you wrote, it is the moral obligation of every leader to eradicate inequities in the system that adversely impacts the people they have been responsible to serve. And we'll never achieve the full promise of our nation until leaders fully assume the challenge of creating educational equity for all children. That had to have been, in the leadership model I follow, I call that a moral focus. It's sort of like, this is who I am, this is what I believe. And it seems like that is what has driven you. I'm curious, when did that form? How did that come to be? Talk a little bit about that statement. It's such a powerful statement. It's right at the top of who you are.
You know, it started for my grandfathers. I was really close with my grandfathers. One, I like to say I come from a mixed family. My one grandfather owned a bar and my other grandfather was a minister. But I traveled with both of them and they had a similar moral compass. And I was always taken aback when I would go to the bar and work, because he put me to work. But I would listen to these older men, older black men typically, and they would talk about how the system wasn't working for them. And when my grandfather would take me home or drive me somewhere, he would always say, so it's your job, you know, eventually you're going to be in a position of decision-making. It's your job to make sure that those guys who are complaining about what the system isn't doing for them works for them. And then being in schools and seeing how we all acknowledge the disproportionality, but don't do anything radical or of substance to address the issue, it's hard to swallow and to see the conclusion and the ramifications of that. So I think it started with my grandfathers. I think it started with me then seeing the system and seeing how it is constructed. It is constructed to help students who travel a certain path. We know that. We know it. And we then acknowledge that certain kids don't get access to that path. So it's not those kids' fault. It's the people who are responsible for the system.
So you just described a philosophy and a focus, and I'm so grateful to know you know, who guided you in that. That must have been some wild Thanksgivings where, you know, both the pastor and the bartender all coming together.
Yeah.
But I'm curious how, so disproportionality is a great example. And for those who are listening who may not be familiar with what that term means, the way I look at it is, let's say you're looking at discipline, for example, and if 50% of your out-of-school suspensions are students of color, and yet your district only has about 25% students of color, then you are disproportionately suspending students of color as compared to any other group. And you can look at it from discipline, you can look at it in terms of academics and achievement. And so when you use that as an example, so how do you use that phrase or that statement to guide those radical decisions? I mean, radical alone doesn't allow, it's hard as a superintendent to be radical as an individual. So you really have to kind of think about how do you harvest the wisdom of your organization and how do you not just collaborate, like really partner in terms of sharing leadership with others so that you're doing that all together. So somebody isn't just saying to you like, yeah, no, we're right behind you. And then you're like, yeah, but how far behind me are you? Like, I'd rather be linked arm in arms with you, not just have you behind me.
You know, that's a really interesting question. I'm reminded of when I was a principal at a high school, and it was a fairly mixed high school. There was an African-American boy who came up to me. His dad was fairly successful. You know, this is Milwaukee, so his dad worked for Miller Beer, right? And so, you know, his dad was an executive at Miller and was doing well. But this kid was traveling that advanced placement track, and he had access. He was not in that pool of the kids that we consider to be disproportionate. But he walked up to me one day and he said, you know, my question for you, what are you going to do about my friends? What are you going to do about it? Are you here for a job and to just ascend to the next job? Or are you going to do something? And then he walked away. And that conversation has haunted me in a positive way, but it's haunted me every day in my career because I have seen colleagues who are just simply getting a paycheck. What I've learned over time is that a superintendent can't be radical all the time. You have to be systemic and systems thinking. But if you're not guided by a moral purpose at some level, then you don't stand for anything. And anyone can be an administrator. And I think that's the beginning of the end of our profession. When there are people who are in leadership roles who don't stand for anything, the messaging will become, well, then anybody can be a superintendent. Anybody can be a school principal. And I think, you know, Peter, everyone can't be a superintendent. There's an element of tying your moral purpose to the systemic thinking that you do with the community building that you do, that all kind of ties together. That is the superintendency. If we water it down to just making sure there's someone who sits at the board table for each board meeting and make sure that the board meeting gets posted, and if that's what the job is, then, you know, there were some old school, if you will, superintendents who mentored me, and they stood for something, and I could watch them from afar and knew that they had a moral compass. My concern for the profession is that I don't see that as often anymore. I see a lot of people who are pursuing the job for title's sake, and it doesn't matter if you have the title or not. If you're not a morally grounded, focused, systemic thinking leader, if you're not focused on a moral purpose and moving your organization from one state to a better state through systems and continuous improvement, then you're just an empty suit.
You know, it's so interesting you say that, and you took the words right out of my mouth, because I was going to say, boy, am I jealous that you had such great mentorship when you first got into the role. And what I observe right now is that superintendents don't. And if the national average of a superintendency is less than 3 years, there's a good reason why. It's because we haven't had the opportunity. You know, you're a good teacher, then you become a good principal, and then all of a sudden you're handed the responsibility of 14,000, 19,000, whatever number of children, and you're supposed to guide a system, and what kind of sort of the skills to do that and how to build good systems. You're, you know, for me, I was like, oh, I was a principal of 300 kids at an elementary school and built relationships and could lead through a relationship. And then you become a superintendent of, you know, close to 20,000 kids and you're going, oh no, you can't, relationships are important, but if you don't build enduring systems, you are just absolutely stuck. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's, we get handed mentors or suggested people to be mentors there right now, sort of sitting superintendents who don't really have the time to give you what you need as if you're just right. aspiring or emerging as a new leader. How does that term, an imperfect leader, resonate with you?
I've been giving it a lot of thought. It scares me, to be honest with you, because I don't know if I think of superintendents, female superintendents, I think of superintendents of color, that margin for error is even tighter. And the ability to be imperfect isn't as, there isn't as much grace offered. But we're fooling ourselves. And this is what I've told my colleague, my, you know, female superintendent friends and friends of color who are superintendents, but we're fooling ourselves if we're saying that we're not making mistakes. We are. It is a frightening place to be because the grace is not there.
Yeah, you've always been told, at least this is my perspective from colleagues of color, women and women of color, who have been told their entire lives, like, they got to work twice as hard to get half as far. And I imagine when you're sitting in the superintendency and you are in charge now, that there are lots of opportunities or lots of people looking to confirm whatever bias or prejudice they have to say, see, I knew it. So let's go move in a different direction. So to embrace imperfection might be a privileged position for someone like me who can say, like, well, I'm imperfect and we're all going to learn from our experiences and we're going to move forward. Like, what a nice place to be able to be.
I worked with a board maybe in my third or fourth year that said, you have a lot of potential, but you're playing it too safe. You need to fail forward. You need to do something. You need to move our organization. You just can't sit in a seat and call yourself the superintendent. And that board provided a level of learning and opportunity to grow that I have never had before. And I think that's what made me a stronger leader, is having that permission.
Yeah, what a blessing. There's a real difference, right? In this case, you weren't making bold statements and taking bold action and having the board say, like, well, we'll see how it goes. They were asking you to take bold decision, you know, bold action. Wow, what a great place to be.
They spoiled me, right? I mean, they've made it bad for others because I'm assuming that that's how boards work. And that's not the case. And, you know, there's a lot of districts that do want to play it safe. And, you know, this is the same community that's fairly affluent, predominantly white. And they said, well, if you believe in if your moral compass is talking about equity, help us see how equity is going to help all kids. And when I was able to unpack that, they were able to get behind it and we were able to move forward in a very positive way and it helped me grow. What I learned from that experience is that it's a gift to have the ability to be an imperfect leader. That's a gift. And it's never about the leader. It's about the people who is supporting that leader and letting them know that they can be imperfect. And you know, when you think about the classroom, that's when the best teachers are at their best. When you tell someone it's okay to make a mistake, that's when they grow. You don't grow from playing it safe. You grow when you try something and you fail.
The last thing I would say before we move to the next section is, you know, imperfect leaders, they often understand that cause and effect are not always closely related in time. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when you make a change, like in your case, making changes focused on equity and inclusion, you have to manage time delays. And the gap between what you want to happen and the time it takes to get the results you want, it can take time. And so this very habit is actually described by the Water Center for Systems Thinking and their habits of system thinking tools. And I love this question that they pose to leaders about managing tensions when you make a change to the system. And in your scenario from that other district, boy, you were in such a great place because they were asking you to take these steps and they were comfortable with the time delay between taking action and getting the results that you would want to get. So they asked this question, and I love it how they pose it to leaders about managing that tension. You know, what will be happening within the system during the time delay that could affect the results that we desire? And so how have you, as you agitate for change, knowing that there's going to be a time delay, and how do you sort of manage the tension?
You know, I don't find it as much of a tension as building the pathway to it. So I think strategic planning is really the crux to it all. If there is a strategic plan that allows us to put the marker in the sand to say, this is what we want to get to, and then allow to make the statement of, now it's time to do the work and we'll measure our progress. And that measurement of progress is not a toxic accountability component, but it's more of a, if we're not hitting our mark, then how can we support you with more resources to get there? So I guess for me, it's, you know, when you think about what's happening in the system as we're working towards the goal, that working, what's happening in the system is really staying focused on the end, keeping the end in mind constantly, keeping that vision of what the end could be is ultimately that's what's happening. It's work, and it's staying diligent, and it's monitoring it in a positive way of, if it's not moving where we need it to, then what resources do we need to provide moving forward?
Yeah, you're speaking to if we're not getting what we want or we expected to get in this time period, what is the mid-course correction we need to take? What is a different lever we need to pull? You know, when I read your statement in our conversation, I know you're agitating for, and agitating is not a bad word. I mean, like, you're trying to like move the system to acknowledge the inequities. And what I have observed from my own experiences have been, you know, when you agitate for change, the system will work aggressively to return back to stasis. Hey, we're doing fine for, you know, all these other folks. And so why do you keep talking about those who have underachieved? We should be talking about the kids who have done really well, and how do we keep pushing them to do even better? And you're going, no, it's not an if or, it's an and. How do we support both? But the moment you, depending on who your board is, depending on who the community leaders are, depending on who your teachers are, those leaders, they'll try to push you away from, like, they'll agitate to get back to stasis, to status quo, where things were going okay, because you're asking me to do something that I might not want to do.
I think if you set out a strategic plan that's really solid and gain enough credibility from multiple stakeholders, those individuals will then have to decide, are you going to become that vocal about it and buck the organizational direction, or are you going to go underground? You know, and some people go underground, and then, but the majority of people do understand the moral imperative and the organizational, I like to call it the promise that school systems are making to families. And most teachers want to fulfill that promise. And so that promise becomes their driver. And when that is morally grounded, and you tell people that there are resources behind that promise, that's typically when you get progress.
I love that. I'm writing that down as a note to myself about the promise we make. You know, some describe it as sort of a social contract, but it really is a promise. And I'm going to be the one who's going to keep that promise. We're going to be the people who keep that promise, right? Yeah. All right, so we're back for segment two of an imperfect leader, imperfect leadership and after action. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they had to make and then discuss it. So as you know, our guest today is Dr. Damon Means, superintendent of the Wauwatosa School District, a school district immediately to the west of Milwaukee. And because I'm a little nerdy, I saw that your city is named for Potawatomi Chief Wauwatosa. And Wauwatosa yes. means firefly. So do you have any yes. schools that the mascot is the firefly?
Absolutely.
Underwood. Yes. Oh, that's yeah, amazing. For sure. All right. All right. I'm going to need some gear, some swag at some point.
There's no doubt.
So if you will, please be a firefly for us. Illuminate for us the situation that you had to navigate. So what happened?
I think for me, it would be when I was in my district in Wisconsin, we were putting together a strategic plan that specifically dealt with the disproportionality and addressing it and really calling out what does continuous improvement look like. And that decision of putting a strategic plan together that is that specific and covers metrics in that level of specificity in a school system that was doing so well was a decision that I think took a lot of thought and consideration.
So here you were, superintendent leading strategic plan with your district and a partner with your board. And the focus was in a high achieving district, looking at disproportionality, so students who may not have been reaching their potential and looking at it from a continuous improvement model. So really sort of setting a goal in the end of where you wanted to be and then sort of setting those markers on how you're going to get there.
Yes.
Okay.
And making and being deliberate, Peter, about putting that part of our strategic planning work was risky.
How?
Because we could have very easily just focused on the percentage of proficient people, proficient kids, and ended it there. But we didn't have to talk about student groups. We didn't have to talk about where we wanted certain student groups to achieve. We could have just said, this is where we want the majority of our kids to land, and they would have landed there. But it forced us to have a deeper conversation around what about all of our kids and what are we doing from an instructional standpoint and from a resource standpoint to reach all of those kids. That was a conscious decision that I thought long and hard about, and it changed the culture of the organization.
So as you look back, what got overlooked?
I think I didn't do a good job in explaining why we wanted to look at all the student groups. I leaned too hard on the moral imperative piece. As a person of color, who can get passionate during my oratory. I think people can get swept away with that and not understand the continuous improvement component of it or the promise that I spoke to earlier of what we need to deliver for every kid.
And so looking back at that, what did you learn about relationships or what new relationships were formed as a result of this?
I think I've learned it over the course of a couple of districts now, and I've learned it here. I think what one thing that I did poorly is that I was speaking directly to teachers about this work. And so I'm going to show my long-term career and how long I've been in the profession. I was trained in the Gallup perceiver and how to give the teacher perceiver and the administrator perceiver. And those of you who are listening, you will know what I'm speaking of in terms of the teacher and the principal perceiver. But in that principal perceiver interview, there's a question regarding, so who does the work? You know, is it you as the principal, or is it you as the principal setting up the stage for others to do the work. And I leapfrogged our principals in relaying the importance of the work. I did a poor job in building the capacity of school leaders to be the individuals to lead the work for their individual schools. I started in my first district in Wisconsin, I was speaking directly to teachers and trying to convince teachers that this work was important. My job should have been more in a role of providing resources and being a cheerleader for those teachers, and then building the capacity of principals to actually execute the work. I've learned it now. And so here in Wauwatosa, I've approached it very differently. My job is to make sure that teachers have everything that they need. Subsequently, my job is also to ensure that principals have the capacity and the skills to lead that work at their individual buildings.
That's really powerful. Similarly, I remember when I first became an assistant superintendent and a family was having trouble at a school, and I went to the family's house and we sat around the kitchen table and we resolved the issue, and I felt great. And then the fallout was the principal who said, well, you didn't give me an opportunity to go do that. So now it appears that I have no interest in that family, that you totally undermined me. And it was right at the beginning of the assistant superintendency. I just didn't even, just like, well, you know, this is the kind of problem solver I want to be and want to build relationships, but didn't take that step back to say, how do I meet with, you know, just a conversation with the principal to say, sounds like this family's really struggling. How do you want to, you know, move forward? How can I help you? How can I support you? What resources do you need? They may have said, look, I've done everything I can possibly do. You go to the house. But I suspect from knowing that principal, they really wished they had had the opportunity to sit down and feel really good about building a meaningful relationship with the family. So that's a really interesting piece. I think that leaders overlook as they move to new roles is where do they fall, not in a hierarchy, but there is like certain roles at different levels in the organization and different expectations about how you support.
I like to use the term that principals live in the buildings. They live with their staff. They're a family. I'm just visiting, you know, so, you know, even if I am on the money and I visit each school twice a month, which is really a lot, that's incredible, right? If I was able to visit each school every week, which is unheard of, if I could visit each school each week, that's 36 visits. There's 178 some odd school days. So my one visit a week, which in the world of a superintendent is incredible, is still a fraction of what the principal has with the faculty. And I think we have lost sight of that. And I don't know. I think some people have glamorized the superintendency. It's not a glamorous job. It's not. When I have young people who say, I want to be a superintendent, my first question to them is why? Because it is not to discourage them. It's to say, if you don't have a moral imperative, if you don't have the skills to put together systems, if you don't have the patience to work with the community in a way of bringing them along and bringing them together, if you don't have all of those things, then it's going to be a very bad job for you. It's not going It won't be rewarding.
Right. And it'll be taxing on you, your health, your family's health.
Unless, and I've seen this more and more, unless you want the job simply for the title. But I think there's some people who just, they're good with that. I think that's why, you know, what you're doing with this podcast is so important, because, you know, and you don't have to be I like to say that the action is really at the principalship level. That's where the action is. That's where our job is to make sure that they have the right resources and we set the vision and we support them. The day-to-day action is in those buildings with principals, leading PLCs, connecting with families, ensuring that they have resources. That's where the real work begins.
So what frustrated you? So you're doing the strategic plan. You're thinking about disproportionality. You're learning a lot about relationships. You kind of identify what got overlooked in terms of going directly to teachers and leapfrogging the principals. What frustrated you?
It was a self-inflicted frustration. But I think the frustration was when you lead with a moral imperative, when you don't get the sense that everyone has that same level of moral drive, if you will, that burn. And I was young in my leadership journey. That was self-inflicted, and I was wrong. And I've grown since then, but that was self-inflicted. It reminds me, Peter, of the story when they talk about how Magic Johnson was the coach for the Lakers for like 20 games, and then he stopped coaching, and it was because he just assumed everyone played like him. You know, one of the greatest players of all time, and that's not how a really good leader, not saying that Magic wasn't a good leader, but I can speak for myself. I wasn't as good of a leader then that I am now, because I don't impose that on everyone. Everyone's going to get to their mark differently. And it's going to come out differently. It was the one component of my teaching years that I forgot, in terms of how people express how they express themselves is going to come off different, and that's okay. It was ironic. The equity guy didn't respect the diversity of how people were coming to their moral imperative. You know, so I think that's been the biggest area of growth for me, from that point 12 years ago to where I am now in terms of leadership.
So that's interesting. I think you've answered those last two questions that I would have for you, is what would you have done differently? And it sounds like going directly to principals and building the capacity and the enthusiasm there, as opposed to going directly to teachers. And it sounds like in the end, what was something that was good that came out of it was a sort of growth in terms of your own leadership model about respecting the individual capacities and strength that people and perspectives that they bring to the work, that, you know, having a shared image of what success looks like, and then having a level of trust and belief that people are going to get there following their own model of leadership and strategy. Does that sound fairly accurate?
That's very accurate, yes.
And there you have it. Dr. Damon Means from the Wauwatosa School District. Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print-inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.